You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
See, the thing about hip-hop fans nowadays is they believe everything they hear, you know, and they forget that this is art.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we have a great conversation with Freddie Fox, a.k.a. Bumpy Knuckles. Since his 1989 debut album, Freddie Fox Is Here, Freddie's been known for his great rhymes and for his frank talk about the state of the record industry, especially on his Industry Shakedown album. He's worked with some of the most legendary figures in hip-hop, including Eric B., DJ Premier, KRS-One, and more. I spoke to Freddie just after the completion of a successful whirlwind European tour with Premier. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Your host, Same Old Sean, here with Freddie Fox, a.k.a. Bumpy Knuckles.
Yes, sir.
Just back from a whirlwind European tour.
Yeah.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, man. We did, Premier and I did 27 shows in 30 days, 2 hours on stage every night. And I mean, you know, it was exciting. I hadn't done a run like that in a long time. And I felt like it was time for me to get back into, you know, the performance side of things. I spent a lot of time recording. And actually staying up on the technicals of what the music business has to offer. You know what I mean? This business not only moves fast in one direction. A lot of cats are chasing the fame, but they're not chasing the technology, or they're not chasing the ability to, you know, they know the Twitter and the Facebook. Or some of these cats from my era don't even mess with that stuff because it's maybe too fast for them or whatever their reason is. But I'm always preparing myself for the technicals. So I spent a lot of time on that. It was a good thing for me to get into the tour, to go back out there to remind myself of the fan base and to remind myself, you know, of how many people have the records and want to hear those songs. And I actually, 2 hours on stage every night, and I didn't even do a small portion. I only did a small portion of my catalog. We did the collection album, some of Industry Shakedown, and that was really it. And that took 2 hours.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the road, one of my favorite lyrics of yours is that, say, my road in life ain't easy because I'm complex.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could just elaborate on that a little bit, and like, in what ways has being, you know, multifaceted and a complicated person maybe held you back career-wise?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you have a solid stance on any subject, mm-hmm. 9 times out of 10, it's easier for people to deal with someone who's complacent with moving how they want you to move. You know, me, I'm not that type of person. I've seen a lot and took a lot of bumps and bruises for cats to be able to do a lot of stuff they do now. And I don't look for no kudos on it. You know what I mean? I felt like when you as an MC, the experiences that I've had, I always wanted to try to take those experiences and rap about them so that guys who are trying to come behind me to make records and do business, manage yourself, write, you know, produce your own music, trying to, you know, figure out marketing on your own and all of those things on your own. And I mean, I had those issues because of my own situation, my ability to respond to people in certain ways that if I don't like something, I say it. Some cats don't like that. They get intimidated by that or they get shook by that. So the complexity that I'm talking about is, you know, my personality. I know I have a strong personality, but that strong personality is based on, you know, having to do things on your own because I don't like being on people's time schedules or, you know, and not all the time. I knew it. And I've gotten better, though. I've gotten a lot better at learning to be more patient with things that, you know, and when you learn how to do things yourself, you know, you gain patience because you realize how difficult it is to get the job done. So other people now you see, okay, wow, I see why it took him so long to make the music or, you know what I mean? So
definitely.
That's the complexity I was talking about.
Yeah. I wanted to take it back for a minute. I was looking at your whole career. Obviously, the first album, mm-hmm. Freddie Fox Is Here, is very like, it's great, but it's a very sort of traditional emceeing style, mm-hmm. very like, you know, lots of boasts mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. The second album has a lot more violent imagery, and you even sound a lot angrier. And I was wondering why maybe that was.
Bill, you know, the experience that I had between the time that I put out Freddie Fox Is Here, you know, when I did Freddie Fox Is Here, I studied the Cold Crush 4, and I was studying what was available for me in hip hop to use as a school book. And, you know, I had the routines and the Grandmaster Caz, and I had those types of influences, you know what I mean? And, you know, to see those kind of artists, you know, that fed me the information, that's what I had. I was excited about making my first album. It was a great thing. Then when the disappointment set in, you know, and to see all of the shadiness and the stuff that went on in between the time I dropped that and Industry Shakedown, it was a lot. And, you know, I put my heart in my music. So when I'm happy, the music is happy. But when I'm angry, you know, the music is angry. But what I did was I was able to put a tag on it so that I can control it. I put Bumpy Knuckles on top of Freddie Fox because it made me able to separate the two personalities and give them identity. If I didn't give Bumpy Knuckles an identity, it would just look like I was spazzing out, you know, without warrants. But, you know, the reason I did that was to be able to contain the Bumpy Knuckles persona under an umbrella that I could market.
That's what I wanted to ask you, is because you use the two names and to an outside observer, it almost seems interchangeable. I was wondering if there is a difference between those two, if you see them as two different identities. I guess you do.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, the Freddie Fox part of me is a lot more of who I am, you know, in reference to, you know, my name really being Freddie. You know what I mean? And the Fox really being a personality about, you know, I always was fly, you know what I mean? I always had clothes, always had, you know, pretty girls around and stuff like that. I always had those things, you know what I mean? And that was the Fox side of me, you know what I mean? It was a nickname given to me because I was always, you know, smooth and able to, you know, come off with this whole, you know, kind of an easygoing dude persona. I'm that way.
Yeah.
You know, I speak soft. I don't, you know, but when the Bumpy Knuckles side of me is presented, that's the rage inside of me that doesn't like to see a record company give you 15 cents on your own dollar or the things that I felt, you know. And I admit it was a scar to be disappointed to walk into a major label. You know, when I watched my moms play Barry White songs as a kid or Isley Brothers records as a kid, you know, you think, wow, somebody has a record deal. That's huge. Like, wow, you walk into this big giant building and all of these offices and all these people are here to help you become this huge figure. And then when you walk in real life, you realize it's not that way. You know, it's like, it's almost like it's like you're better off getting a loan from a bank and finding your own people to get the music the way you want, because to deal with the record business was the record industry was definitely a traumatic experience in the beginning because I wasn't ready to handle the negative backlash or the feedback. I wasn't negative feedback. I wasn't ready for that. You know, I was just looking at, wow, this is good. You know, if it worked for him, it's going to work for me. So that's where the whole separation comes in. So what I did was created this that persona of Bumpy Knuckles. I put a name on the anger. The anger is real. The words that I spit are real. But you can't, that's Freddie Fox saying it, but it's almost like that the devil and the angel on your shoulder kind of thing. You know what I mean?
That's awesome. In that answer, you were talking about your first record there. You talked about the early MCs, you know, Cold Crush and that kind of stuff. You have that lyric on RNS where you're talking about, you know, you used to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And because of listening to them, you were saying you were getting something that people today aren't getting.
Yeah.
If you had to put it into words, what is that something that you're talking about?
Just that real, like, it's like when you watch, the difference between me watching the Grandmaster Caz's and the Melly Mel's and, you know, the Love Bug Starskys, Hollywood and all of those great forefathers that did this, they showed you how to create something. Like, to watch the Cold Crush take a song like a Luther Vandross record and change the words, keep the melody, and sing a harmony of the words and with their own voice and call it. Oh, these are harmonizers. We learned that from them. Yeah. You know,
and you did that a bit when you were starting out.
Yeah, we did that when we started out because we were learning from them to see them talk about, you know, when Mo Dees did, you know, go see the doctor, or he did these around Dougie Fresh, came out of the Globe on stage. You know, you see these types of influences in hip hop. It feeds you a diverse, you know, but balanced for a group of information, a list of information about being an MC and performing and having that dynamic, but everybody sounding different. Whereas today, you know, if one dude come out and he start, you know, hacking on a record like a goat, before he start rapping, now you got 90 little kids that come out and the first thing they say before they rap is, you know, it's like, it's just off, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, what happened to the diversity, or what happened to the information being fed that, you know, this is who I am, you know? So what I did on tour, my message to the audience was, you know, don't follow that now. Follow what you're doing here. Create in your city, in Lithuania, in Bulgaria, in Germany, in Switzerland, in the UK, or wherever you are. Develop whatever you're starting here. Turn it into something that no one has ever seen before, and then build it in your. Let this be like, this is the UK way of doing it, or this is the Japanese way of doing it, and develop that. You know, don't mimic what you see happening in the States now, because they're not following a pattern that really teaches you anything outside of what, you know, this is what I do. Either you copy that or you corny. Like, that's not real.
Right.
I don't want nobody rapping like me. I want people to take something from me and add your own to it and make it your own thing, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of people rapping like you,
yeah,
you've definitely admitted ghostwriting for lots of well-known people.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than, you know, so I was curious about something, not names, because obviously that's, you know, mm-hmm, dead end. But how is it different writing a rhyme for someone else than writing a rhyme for yourself? Like, if you were to tell me, hey, I wrote record X, mm-hmm, could I go back and be like, oh, that's Freddie's flow, that's Freddie's rhyme scheme?
Not if I didn't tell you. If I told you I did it, then you would hear it different. But if I didn't tell you, you wouldn't be able to pick them out.
Mm-hmm.
Because the beauty of doing ghostwriting for people is that you get a chance to, behind the scenes, you get a chance to take a professional MC that's visually professional, you know, and pin something that you think fits them. It's like being a shoe salesman. You could say, this shoe really fits your foot, you know, and then you gotta give it to them and say, okay, say it like this. So what I would do is I would go into the studio. The producers would call me, and I would go into the studio. I would lay the verse down the way I wanted them to say it. And then I would say, this is how it's supposed to be said. But when you say it, then you add your voice to it. You got to keep in mind, some females that I wrote for, or some, you know, who have lighter voices, I had to kind of tell them, okay, use your voice. But now, when you say this line, you know, I want you to breathe a little bit more here. It's almost like training a singer, because I customize it for them. I wouldn't have said it for myself that way. But, you know, I would never give an MC a rhyme that I wouldn't say myself. So it's different in the fact that you're customizing something for somebody else. You definitely wouldn't be able to tell that I wrote it because I customized it. So I didn't, you know, to me, it would be lazy for me to write a rhyme that I would
sounds
say
just like you.
That sounds just like me. Yeah. So, you know.
Okay, cool. The song Intelligent Thug, mm-hmm. There was some, you know, the overarching theme of it is
the skit.
Like,
it's a skit, yeah.
The skit, yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. How sort of, you know, thugs got into the music industry, mm-hmm. right? How street folks kind of embedded themselves in there. So, you know, 12 years later, is that still the case? Like, if not, because there's obviously less money to be made in the music mm-hmm. industry, where are those folks going?
Well, it's the case in a different way. It's the case in a different way because now a lot of those street guys, old and wiser, of course,
yeah.
have experienced the music business in some sort of success in it. The ones that have started record companies and, you know, subsidiaries and so forth and so on. So they know how to actually handle the business now, especially with the power of the internet. You don't really, you know, their power is better utilized in the corporate offices now, because the guys in the corporate offices that want to find a balance between street and corporate, you know, so the, you know, Sony or Universal or one of these guys will go hire a local dude who was a barbershop guy or somebody who's, you know, these so-called street team guys are now sit behind A&R desks. They still scared of those same street dudes. But they don't, you know, they got the artists down. Now, this is my label. These are my artists. Now they can get a check from the same cat that shits bricks every time he sees them. So it's like, I need a check for you, you know, for my groups. And then they want to talk business. It's the smart thing about the street guy is that he knows how to, you know, it's not a bully thing anymore. It's a thing like, yo, you know who I am, dude. Like, don't give me the pick up my call and he's busy and all that. I don't want to hear that. You know, I got an artist. You told me this is what it is now. You know, that's the kind of situation it is nowadays. You know, and it's not as popular as it used to be because, you know, some of these guys now are A&R. Some of these street guys have gotten deals as in record labels where they're the ones signing the groups. Now, this is a whole nother day now. So, you know, it's not as popular anymore.
On a sort of related topic, you have this really great line. You said, everything I rhyme about ain't all about violence, even if I put violence in it. Mm. And that really caught my attention. Can you maybe break that down for us? Do you sometimes use violence on your records in like a more complicated, like not literal sort of metaphoric way?
Yeah. Metaphor is very important to me. You know, if I rap about violence, it doesn't always mean that that's my intention. See, the thing about hip hop fans nowadays is they believe everything they hear, you know, and they forget that this is art, you know, this is another form of art. So, if a painter says this on this canvas, these colors represent rage. It may not necessarily be his rage just because he painted it. You know, having a vision, you know, vision is the art of seeing things that are not visible, you know, like it's like seeing emotion or seeing, you know, emotion is a powerful thing, you know, and if you don't know how to control it, you know, or you see it, let's say if I see a fight in the street, you know, and I see two cab drivers fighting at each other, you know, that may inspire me to write something a certain way. So it's not always about my violence. It could be about the violence that I see on the news or the violence that I see anywhere. That's what I meant about that. It's, you know, I'm not all about violence. People, you know, they prejudge you or tag you as a certain person. Once they hold on to a lyric you've said, you can become that. So you have to kind of, I don't know if people listen as deep as that though. Some of that stuff flies over people's heads, you know. The fact that you picked it out is interesting to me.
Yeah. You know? I wanted to kind of change tacks for a second. You and that Speakers in the Park tune, you talk about the early park jams,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which got me thinking, I was wondering, you know, what's your earliest hip hop memory? Because at the time of those park jams, you would have been just a little kid.
Yeah, I was, I'm 45, so park jams were happening when I was a teenager. They were happening, you know, when I was really grooming myself for the mic. I never expected to take it to where I was touring the world or anything like that. But my earliest memory, I remember going to a Mike and Dave concert. Mike and Dave were some DJ promoters that used to promote parties, and they would bring the Cold Crush. And the first time I ever saw Dougie Fresh was at a Mike and Dave show, I think it was. And the Cold Crush 4 and them guys used to come out with these outfits on, and I'd be in the front row looking like, wow, look at this, it's huge. You know, my dream was to always play on the same stage as the Cold Crush 4. And I can remember when there's a place in Amityville called the Ace Center, and I played at the Ace Center, and it was a big deal for me to be on stage with the Cold Crush 4. So I get a message from the party promoter that the Cold Crush said we can't stand on the stage. We had to stand at the DJ booth, which was down below the stage. And I was like, dang, I wanted to rock on the stage, you know. But that was I was a shorty then. It was, and they were like, they were huge. Just to see, they were like the Jackson 5 or the Hour 4 Tops, or, you know, they were huge back in those days. And I remember all of my hip-hop memories, you know, even from before that time. We used to rock at roller skating rings. I was always doing rap battles and things of that nature. So I have a pretty vivid, you know, memory of doing shows in parks and backyard parties and stuff like that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, because you shout out the Union Square Club on MCs Come and MCs Go. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that club in particular?
Union Square was, you know, it was a big deal to be able to go to Union Square, you know, to be out there and see the crowds of people just coming, you know, to see the performances, or just to hear the DJs play. It was always a big deal to play it at the Red Zone and all the different clubs that they had around New York. You know, just all that experience right there was college. Because you could get on stage in one night, and some of the biggest MCs now, you would have to rock with Kane and Rakim and G-Rap and Scarface and, you know, all of those dudes, and Large Professor, and all of those dudes were right there, you know, easy.
That's incredible. Is there any one particular battle you remember either watching or being a part of, either in that club?
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Something else from that era?
I battled Big Daddy Kane at Latin Quarters, and that was the first time I seen Public Enemy. Public Enemy performed, and Chuck D had the laces tied up around his legs, and Flavor had the cowboy hat on with long braids in his hair. And me and Kane had I was in the Supreme Force at the time, and it was us three, and then Kane came with the leather hat on, and it was a battle that he and I ended up, you know, having.
Yeah. So 86, 87?
Yeah, it was in the 80s. It was around the 80s. Yeah, 80. I was out of, it was 86. It might have been 86, 87 around that time.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Speaking of people like Kane and Chuck D and stuff, mm-hmm. on We Are War, you have that really funny line about like top five MCs and whatever. Yeah. You know. You can look that up on Rap Genius if you don't know the line I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So who's in your top five?
I don't have a top five, I don't think. I don't like doing top anything. Mm-hmm. I think just, you know what it is? Because it switches. You know, I can be honest. I tell you, I love KRS-One is my favorite MC.
Right, and you've obviously
without a doubt. Because what I like about Chris is he's always concerned about being on point with his lyrics, which a lot of MCs they got to the point where they don't care about that no more. Like when you try to cross those timelines with the lyrical professionalism of a KRS-One, it's amazing to hear him spit live. And he could walk on any stage and don't have a DJ and say, yo, anybody in the crowd know how to DJ? Okay, you come on up here, get on the turntables. And you know, he puts the DJ to work to support what he does lyrically. But if the DJ falls short, he'd never fall short lyrically. He just continues to keep on rocking. He's accomplished so much lyrically and given so much information out lyrically to people that he's powerful enough lyrically to build his own community, because people stand by, you know, stand on his word. Like, you know, and then you got a guy like Kane who performs his stuff so poignantly, oh, now that's a very big part, not only of just making dope rhymes, but being able to present them, you know what I mean, and make sure that you can say something that people want to, they want to see or hear you say it. And I'm a big fan of the performance of Big Daddy Kane, and lyrically, Kane is always dope to me. I like Jay-Z because Jay-Z was able to make a transition from being a street hustler to one of the richest MCs to ever, you know, make records. And you have to know your business and be sharp business-wise to do that. So which is, if you notice, each MC that I pick has a different element stronger. Now, Jay-Z's dope lyrically. You know, his presentation is not as strong as a Kane, but, you know, he definitely has that ability to say, okay, well, I got enough money to put the things around me. You know what I mean? I'm talking straight. You know what I mean? If I watch Jay-Z perform on stage, he's boring to me just to stand there if he stood there. But when he puts the things around him that can show you to take away from him doing all the extras, you know, he ain't going to do what Kane do on stage. And Kane was a big influence on Jay-Z.
Right, they collaborated and hung out together, and he was kind of Kane's protege for a while.
Yeah, Kane was definitely somebody who I know was an influence on a Jay-Z. You know, I like LL Cool J because LL has that element of presentation. You know, he's definitely about how he sticks to what he does. You know what I mean? He's not going to step outside. LL's not going to step outside of what he does too far, which is a brilliant move when you set a pattern for yourself for so many years. He knows that, you know, if the ladies like you, and you rap to the ladies, you know, a lot of dudes need that. They need to know that, you know, you have to find balance, you know, when you have the ability to lay your vocals out that way. LL is dope when it comes to that. I also like I like Public Enemy because Public Enemy is another group that, you know, being as a group they feed each other's and they feed off of each other very well. Especially Chuck D is he's a lot heavier than cats can imagine. If you listen to his rhymes, you know, he gives you what a KRS-One gives you, but just in a different way. It's a lot more radical. And that side of me, the radical side of me, is attracted to the Public Enemy sound because it leads you into, like, you know, you got to remember you got to stand for something at some point. You know, you got to stand for something at some point when you are a lyricist or you're an MC, because if you're just rapping about frivolous nonsense, at one point you sink. There's nothing to float your whole persona, you know. Then the Public Enemy persona is dope. Everybody thought that Flavor Flav was just some kind of buffoon that was comedy relief, which technically he's a very brilliant individual.
And yeah, you also need him because otherwise Chuck might come off as, you know, maybe a little too much.
Yeah, he can, you know, Flav, you know, one thing about people that don't understand you, they're more comfortable with you when you're clowning. When you're laughing and you're smiling and you're clowning, and then, you know, it can also be a very dangerous tool to draw people in. You know, I said in one of my lyrics, you know, I'm a lot more dangerous when I'm clowning. You know, because when you lure people in, you know, this frown, you know, that was the saying, you get more with sugar than salt or vinegar,
yeah,
whatever
yeah,
the case
yeah,
is. You know, that's
there, yeah.
You know, him and Flav are the you know what I mean? So
definitely. Speaking of, you know, political things, in the warm up on the Leaks Volume 2, which is great. Mm-hmm. It's a great great record.
Thank you.
Yeah. You mentioned H. Rap Brown's book.
Oh yeah.
In that. What effect did that book have on you when you read it?
Oh, Die Nigga Die, man. People can never forget. People should never forget what we've been through, you know, in this country, you know, and the fights and what's so powerful about remembering racism and remembering how blacks have been treated or minorities have been treated is that hip hop kind of solved a lot of those problems in our culture. Cause I live in a hip hop culture, you know, I live in a world that hip hop culture exists in, but I live in hip hop culture. You know, everything I do in my life, I represent hip hop. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing for me to step on stage and remember H-Rap Brown and his experiences and his books, and then look out in the crowd and see all white kids that love my music. You know, that and then that I can influence them to have their individual mindsets not be so trivial as to see me as a black man less than them.
That's kind of one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because on the Connection record, this is sort of one of the themes in what you said now about like hip hop being really the first, you know, cross-racial youth music.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wanted to ask you about the exact thing you just pointed out. How do you take it from, you know, oh, I like this music, to, you know, let me see the performers and people who look like them as human, and, you know, see what, you know, sort of the larger social picture around that?
It's the beat, you know, when you have a common denominator like the drums, you know, you understand what the heartbeat of Africa was about. So now the conversations that I have with someone like that looks like you, it opens up a door to my life, and you open up the door to the other. Yo, what kind of food? You know, come to my house, let's eat, man. I'm a big fan of your music. I want to host your show. And then you start saying, yo, man, listen, I'm from Yugoslavia. This is what we eat, man. I want you to try it. And then, you know, my rider has certain food on it that I like, and it's like, oh, I never heard of that before. And then you start, those types of, hip hop opens up those type of conversations. You know, my mom and my pops would have never had conversations with your moms and your pops because they didn't have any kind of common denominator. The food that people were fed were, you know, those people are less than us, or, you know, and it's not just black and white. It's a lot of things that cause those type of ignorant stereotypes to become food for somebody's brain who won't think past the unity stripe. Like, hip hop is about, you know, the Public Enemy said, fight the power. That's what James Brown said, I'm black and I'm proud, you know. KRS-One, when we made Heal Yourself, you know, he was like very, he told me recently that I said one of the strongest lines in the whole song about light-skinned women being, you know, the surface of a dark, deep well, you know. And if you listen to the lyric, it's just a Curtis Mayfield line. You know, if you listen to We People Who Are Darker Than Blue, you know, if you listen to that, you'll notice that line is a Curtis Mayfield line. And it's like, you know, and I used it because it fit, and I had really been studying that from Kurt, and I liked it. So the point I'm making is that hip hop has put a Band-Aid on race. You know, if you look at, you know, at some of the styles of clothes. I mean, back in the days when I was in high school, it was like all the pagans and all of the so-called fraternities, they had the Disco Sucks shirt on, and we found ourselves representing disco. Like, that was black music. You know, the disco don't suck, rock sucks. And it was like we were arguing over something that really was one and the same in some context, because it was music. You know what I mean? And everybody has a right to like what they like, but hip-hop changed the perception of race as far as the culture is concerned. I believe that, and I know people may beg to differ, but I believe that hip-hop changed the way I saw Caucasians, and a lot, and my fans are 90% white kids that like love my rage, and they love, because they're the most rebellious kids in the world. I mean, you can have a white kid whose father's a doctor and his mother's a lawyer, and he still got on his Def Leppard shirt like, fuck the world, you know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? So, you know, and I've seen those kids, and I relate to those kids. It's just what it is, you know.
Nice. You had that one, you have a really great line, I think it's on Part of My Life, where you say how a lot of black people either ride with the Bloods, the Muslims, or call on Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you say that, unless I'm misreading it, is like not exactly negative,
that's on My Thoughts.
Oh, on My Thoughts, yeah. I apologize. It's seems to present these as if not exactly negative, then like at least limited options. So I guess I was wondering, like, how do you think you can present young people with more alternatives? And also, where did you, when you were young, fit in on that?
Well,
list?
You know what? You know what it is. When you go to prison, what I was speaking about in prison wasn't about. It wasn't actually about the caged in prison. It was about society, the prison in society, and I wanted to change the line from bloods to gangs. On stage, I say gangs, Muslims are calling on Jesus, because you kind of get these options to follow something in society, which is like, you see people, you know, one thing I respect about the gangs is their ability to organize. And just like you got the Muslims' ability to organize, the Hasidic Jews organize, you know, they're any kind of organization, you know, is I respect the ability to organize. How you organize it and what that organization represents is a whole nother ball game. But if you got to be down with something, whether you start it yourself or, you know, the loners in this world are just what they are, you know. And I found myself, you know, growing up in the Baptist household, and then, you know, venturing out on my own and discovering friends who were into Islam and schooling me and teaching me about Islam, and then gaining from those things what I thought best suited my life, and then taking him and implying that into my music and then spitting it back out to the world. So, you know, I know the Christians and the Christian lives and what it's about. I've seen some shady stuff in Christianity. I know Islam, and I've seen some shady stuff in Islam. So you have to not get caught up in, you know, being, you know, totally dedicated to things good, bad, and indifferent about one thing. What I do is I feel like, let me take a little bit of here, and this is what suits me. I don't want to be down with that. You know what I mean? I don't want nobody picking my wife, and I don't want to be down with, not with all that, being real with you. So I decided, let me just grab what I need from this. If you read a Bible or you read a Quran or a Torah or whatever you read, a Surah, whatever it is you read, you get what you can out of it. And then you use it the way you need it for yourself, because you have to live your life yourself. That's how I balance it. It's like, I'm not going to be stuck doing one thing because somebody else tells me it's the right thing to do. That's just not me. I'm not doing that.
I wanted to ask you a couple more things.
No, it's cool. Take it off.
Yeah. On the Industry Shakedown record, you're kind of pining for a time. I guess that record was 2000, right?
Yeah.
So maybe a time before that. And you say when selling crack and jewels was not so relevant. Mm-hmm. And my question is, when did you first notice that kind of talk was becoming everything in rap? And what to you, was there like a single tipping point where you saw something and you were like, oh, everything is this now?
Yeah. I think it was more like in the mid 90s, like toward the mid to later 90s, when I started to really see, you know, and that came from a lot of the hustlers that from the street coming into the rap game and grabbing MCs and making them their artists, and then, you know, I'm gonna manage you. You know, yo man, what you rapping about that for, man? Leave that girl stuff to LL Cool J, man. We out here in the street trying to get this money, man. You gotta rap about that. And that is when you started to see, not to say that everybody was following the advice of some street cat, but the ones that were, for some reason it seemed like they were getting a look, that brass. You know, Run DMC had a lot to do with hip-hop becoming more raw. And it wasn't about, and this is something that a lot of cats got, it's a jewel for a lot of cats that don't know. See, what you heard Run DMC rap about was always positive and always fun. But if you looked at them with black leather suits on, it just was really street. And they gave people a sense, the feeling in the sense that, yo, I don't have to follow a trend of, you know, feathers or whatever was out before that. You know what I mean? From that era, it opened up the door for cats to loosen up a little bit more. And then as time went on, you know, it was very few MCs that would change hip hop, not only just lyrically, but you know, the whole Rakim, for instance, he when he came out, a lot of rappers changed the way they flowed. You know what I mean? Because he presented a different rhyme flow style from that whole party flow that everybody had to something that was more laid back. And, you know, and then Busta Rhymes came out and his dynamic delivery shocked everybody into doing something. You know, it was a stint between, but very few cats have an individuality that's as strong as a Sadat X, who I don't think no one has a voice like. You know, those type of, you can hand pick them because there's very few of them out there.
Yeah. What do you think your biggest strengths as an MC are? When you're talking about your favorites, you said, well, this one is good at this, and this one is good at this, and this one is strong here. What do you think your strengths are?
Diligence, man. I just, you know, I don't get caught up in the trends and stuff. You know, a lot of cats be like, yo, Bumpy still makes some hot records and he's 45 years old. I'm like, well, listen, if Bruce Springsteen can do it, I may not be as big as Bruce, but you know, he's up there, you know, we take care of our own, you know what I'm saying? He can do his thing, I can do mine, you know what I mean? So I don't see any reason because we're all getting older. You know, I don't know anyone, you know, you can fool yourself into thinking you're getting younger, but we're all getting older. You know, I remember when I didn't have a gray hair in my beard, and with the shock of a gray hair had me twisted. I was making phone calls like, yo, B, look, you get tired of pulling them after a while. And then it doesn't change how you rhyme. It doesn't change how you make your music. You still have those talents. But I think the fact that I keep, you know, because I know a few guys on tour said to me, yo, man, after watching your show, I ran into Donald D., you know, who's a legend.
From Ice-T's group.
Yeah, he's a legend. Donald D's a legend in the music business, in hip-hop, in our world. He's a legend. And it's like, yo, Donald said, yo, man, I'm glad I saw you in Primo, man, because now I realize, you know, it just gave me so much insight. I'm backstage doing my little remedy to keep my throat together, man, because I was on stage and I was sick in Vienna. But I, you know, and Premier was looking at me going, you got to dig deep, Bump. And I was like, yeah, you know, and every night we pull it off. But that inspires guys to, you know, keep rocking. Don't stop rocking, because I feel like we have a culture. I don't like the term save hip hop. I hate that. I don't like bring it back. I don't like none of that. We have to keep it nourished. You know what I mean? Because I don't think hip hop is gone. I think Nas was a genius when he said hip-hop was dead.
Definitely sparked a lot of conversation.
And I think that's what he was intending to do. I don't think he was saying that it's dead. I think what he was trying to say was that, you know, the people who are supposed to be helping to nourish the culture have sat down, get back up, and keep pushing to keep. No, you can't say hip-hop is dead and you're still doing hip-hop. That's just, you know, anybody with half a brain would know that. But that's where I'm at with it. Where like my thing is diligence. I believe that I show people or give people a vision of what they should be doing in the next 20 years. I mean, I live hip hop every day. So you say some cats who are not as serious about it as I am, and they won't rock as long as I have been rocking, because they don't have the time to say, well, I ain't, you know, I mean, years ago, I after seeing Mark the 45 King and DJ Kool V, from who DJ for Bismarcky, when I saw that they had home studios, nothing was gonna stop me from building a studio. I've built 7 studios since then.
Awesome. I wanted to, just because some of the other people I've talked to recently were around during the East Coast West Coast feud. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to Combat Jack Reggie Osei, who was, you know, doing, working with a lot of the people on the Bad Boy side, and, mm-hmm. and to D-Dot, and I kind of got their takes and their impressions on that. Mm-hmm. And so I was listening to Stock in the Game, and it seems like you're saying it wouldn't have been so bad if the East Coast side of things had retaliated more initially rather than kind of sitting back.
Yeah.
Do you still feel that way?
What I said was, what I felt was, that whenever there's a problem between something that's pop, hip hop is huge, and I mean, to have somebody aggressively just coming at you all the time, it's not always a good idea to cower down, to, you know, cower. When you cower down, you build the confidence of the aggressor, you know. But if you stand up and say, yo, check this out, don't make me do this to you. Now, if you want to fix this, we can fix, but don't make me do this to you. Because if you make me go here, once it's on, the beef don't start till I set it. The war ain't over till I win. Don't make me go there. You got to stand up for yourself. I understand the whole turn the other cheek thing and all that. That don't work for everybody. I got a lot of friends on the West Coast. A lot of friends on the West Coast. And I never felt a West Coast problem. Because when you in that loop or that situation, I think media took a lot of that and blew it out of proportion, and like they always do, and they try to keep, you know, they try to keep us in the dogfight all the time because it's entertaining. And then when somebody gets hurt, killed, or something happens, then they want to say, oh, hip hop should stop this. This is horrible. They throw the rock and hide their hand. So that's part of the problem as well. I never felt that. I think that when you look at that whole East Coast versus West Coast thing, they put a title on it. There was cats from other places that from the Midwest, you know, they were not involved, you know, so like, you know what I mean? Like it was an internal
situation. Pac was a New Yorker.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. and a very good friend of mine. I got some letters that he wrote me that I never really show nobody that, you know, it's just really sad that, you know, that situation titled by the media caused two of the best MCs in hip hop to not be here anymore. And that's what the cause was, because if they wouldn't have paid it no attention, we're not gonna feed into that in hip hop. You know, we don't wanna feed the fans that. It would have probably died out.
Because you can end up on the cover of Vibe by
right.
doing records.
Exactly. But when you got the cover of a major magazine and you talking about fuck the East Coast or fuck the West Coast, the fans start to feel that, because some people are from the East, some people from the West, and then you got people on the outskirts having to pick a side, you know? It just perpetuated a big problem that could have been avoided. And to me it was unnecessary, it was sad. I mean, there's beefs, but if Biggie and Pac had a problem, I bet you'd lock them two in a room together, it would have been over.
So speaking of beefs and disagreements, reminds me of professional wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
You are on on the leaks thing. You say you have a brotherly bond with John Cena.
Yeah, that's
what's,
my boy.
How'd you guys meet? I know you did some music for the WWE.
Yeah. Me and John had an arm wrestling match at Hot 97 one morning.
Yeah. Can I ask who won? Is it a matter of public record?
Nah. I almost had him, and then the guy that did jumped on his back, and then he interrupted it. But John had he was in the green room waiting to be on, and I didn't know Sway is a very good friend of mine, was hosting at the time, and he wanted me to, he was going to have John Cena rap and me kind of judge his abilities. So I was like, okay, cool. So I went there, and I hadn't watched wrestling in so many years, I wasn't really hip to John Cena. But when I got there and he rhymed, you know, his verse was dope. But I said, they said, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give him? And I said, right now I give him a 5, but if he roll with me, he'll be a 10. So we went backstage, and he was like, yo, I'm a big fan of music, blah, blah, blah. And then we shook hands, he gave me his number. And then we just gradually started to talk. Then it ended up where he wanted to do a rap album. And he came to my studio, and then it was done from there. Like, real cool dude, man. Just like, it's very rare that you meet guys that big in status, as far as celebrity status and what he does in wrestling on TV. I mean, he has fans from 8 to 80 around the world. And this guy called my phone, and we'll sit on the phone and crack up laughing about stuff. And he's just a cool dude. And I found that to be surprising, because you very rarely meet guys who are that, you know, open-minded and friendly when they have so much going for them. That, you know, you usually run, in hip hop, you run into a lot of arrogance when cats become, they go from broke to rich, and then they, you know, they can change, you know, or any kind of business for that matter. But John is a very good friend of mine.
Off camera, we were talking before about some of the things you're up to. I was wondering maybe you could fill our audience in.
Yeah, Premier and I talk about doing Collection 2. I have a few joints, maybe four joints done for Collection 2. I have OC Bumpy Knuckles project coming out.
Yeah, OC has been on the show. You can go check our back catalog. We had him and AJ on, and he spoke very, very highly.
Yeah, that's my boy. That's my boy. OC is nice. A lot of cats. If you listen more to lyrics, you'll see a lot of MCs that you overlook. See, people have to learn to listen a little bit deeper to these records, because when you start listening to the rhymes and dissecting the rhymes, I miss the fans. I miss hip-hop fans as far as everybody trying to be a rapper or a manager. I'm a booking agent, rapper, manager, and I wash your car for extra $20. You know, I got Wayne Ski, Bumpy Knuckles, Black Heart album is coming out. I'm doing a JoJo Pellegrino EP, V Styles EP. He's from Detroit. You know, I got a few other projects. I'm handpicking these MCs that I want to work with production-wise. I've been a producer for 15, 20 years. So I got a lot of production that I've been, you know, stacking catalog just to really kind of underlay some of these nice guys, man, and some of their skills. And then I'm gonna do some more music. I'm just gonna keep doing music till I'm tired. I have Corrupt Mob Radio that I'm on the air on Thursdays and Mondays, and Sunday nights is Miss Parker, who does her show on Sunday night. So I'm trying to feed people, because I don't play the radio games. If I get a radio record and they pick it, that's on them. I'm not going to go to radio going, oh, play my record. You know, I don't feel that those days are really here for me anymore. You know, and I'm living my life. I'm enjoying living my life, man. You know, I have two beautiful daughters, and I have
one of them's a great rhymer.
Yeah. Oh, Jana. Yeah, Jana. I had an interview in Switzerland, and the guy asked me about it, and I had to do a double take. He was like, you know, we played that on an underground show, you know. So my nephew, my brother's son, Tayshawn, has a group called OMTF on my free time. I'm working with them, helping them out. So there's a bunch of stuff that I got going on. And
plus your Rap Genius verified account.
That's gangster. I can't wait to get it. So I'm gonna be doing some. I like to do the video thing, so you'll see a bunch of videos on my page. Hopefully, your server can handle all the videos.
I hope so. We're looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
Awesome, man. Thank you. Right. Salute.
That was our conversation with Freddie Fox, aka Bumpy Knuckles. But we have a little bonus material for you, straight from Freddie's verified Rap Genius account. Here are his thoughts about his late great friend, Guru of Gangstar.
Yeah, Guru, salute Guru on Gifted Unlimited Rhymes. The Guru that I know, you know, from touring, from recording with and just having that whole, you know, when you live with somebody on a tour for as long as we stayed on the road on the Smoking Grooves tour and other dates that we've done, you see a person who develops into, you know, outside of the whole stage persona, but you know the person who's, you know, one person one way on stage and another person outside. So I always try to big Guru up to keep his name in a positive light. You know, we had our fights and our disagreements, but, you know, never physical, you know what I mean? But way more good times than bad. So I always try to keep Guru's name in a positive light. A lot of times people want to interview me about the negative stuff, you know what I mean? But I don't feed into that, because that's not something I'm interested in doing, is ever saying anything derogatory or negative about, you know, Guru to media like that. You know, when he was alive, you know, like I said, we had our disagreements, but, you know, it was always something that... Yeah, it was always something that could be fixed at some point. So I always try to salute Guru. I always try to remember that he was an MC who inspired, you know, a lot of things that I've accomplished. He set that off for me when it came to Gangstar. Him, it was a combination of him and Premier. So, you know, it bothered me when they split up because of why it happened and how it happened. And I was angry with him about allowing it to happen. You know, but, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, I always, like I said, like to speak positive about Guru, so I'll stay with that.
That's it for our conversation with Freddie Fox, a.k.a. Bumpy Knuckles. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of Outside the Lines, please go to iTunes and give us a review. The more five-star reviews we get, the easier it is to keep getting incredible guests like Freddie Fox. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. This interview was recorded by our loyal intern Sonny Kahara and filmed by Liam Omar Cummin Billingham. The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
You know, this is what I do. Either you copy that or you corny.
Music by the one and only Psionic. Our web guru of the upcoming OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice. If you want to reach me with your thoughts about the show, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean. That's S-H-A-W-N. Thanks for listening, and join us next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, when we have a great conversation with the New Orleans rapper D1 and a talk with R&B singer Balak.